call one more time, cause number 17761CV. Mr. Bennett, whenever you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court. The board's decision in this case poses a serious threat both to the proper functioning of Texas administrative law, as shown by Professor Ron Beal's amicus brief, and to the automotive industry, as shown by the automaker's amicus brief that was filed. The reason why this is so is primarily because of two legal errors that the board committed, which permeate and invalidate its final order. The first is the board's usurpation of SOA's role as the finder of basic facts in an APA contested case process. And second, the board's failure to provide a logical explanation and evidentiary basis for rejecting the SOA judge's findings. Because of these legal errors, SOA's role as the independent, neutral fact finder has been subverted, and the board has created a vague and confusing legal standard that violates Texas law and is contrary to the nationwide established industry practice of giving extra discretionary allocations to dealers who participate in manufacturer-sponsored programs and renovate and upgrade their facilities to better serve the motoring public. This court should vacate the board's order and remand the case to the board with instructions to reconsider it in accordance with the APA's requirements. In 1975, the legislature enacted the APA to ensure that state agencies engage in reasoned decision-making that is fair to all parties. And they did this by requiring agencies to make two kinds of findings in a contested case proceeding: basic findings that logically support ultimate findings or conclusions of law. Then in 1991, the legislature created SOA to be this independent finder of fact. And it amended the APA to make SOA the finder of those basic facts in these cases and to recommend findings of ultimate fact or conclusions of law to the agency. Now, basic facts are those that concern who did what, where, when, how, with what motive or what intent. They resemble the facts that a jury would find. Under Section 058E of the APA, the board has no authority to reject or change an ALJ's basic fact finding that has evidentiary support. This court has said this is a hallmark of the administrative process. The SOA judge is made the sole judge of witness credibility, and the SOA judge resolves conflicts in the evidence. And the agency's function is not to reweigh the evidence and start changing basic facts after a hearing before a SOA ALJ. Now, in this case, I want to emphasize the board rejected no finding of the ALJ for a lack of evidentiary support.
Mr. Bennett, can I interrupt you for a
second?
Yes, ma'am. If we disagree with you that these are basic facts, and we think that instead they're, ultimate facts.
Ultimate facts, right.
Then tell me, what would constitute a sufficient explanation for the board to have changed?
Yes. Your Honor, it's more than saying the ALJ misapplied the law. That's just boilerplate. And that's the only reason that the agency gave here. You have to explain logically how the ALJ misapplied the law. And there has to be an evidentiary basis for that that's supported by basic findings of fact. We don't have that in this case. The board just said, well, we think she misapplied the law. The ALJ did. And for the allocation deal, they said, and there was a 7-to-1 disparity in discretionary allocations here. And Hyundai treated its dealers differently. Well, the statute allows that. The statute 468-2 allows there to be a difference in allocations among the dealers. It just can't constitute unreasonable discrimination.
Unfair.
Now, where we got a hole here, Your Honor, is there are no basic findings that support an ultimate finding of unreasonable discrimination. In fact, the board adopted the ALJ's findings, which support that there was reasonable
including 50,
difference.
Right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, what do we do with, like, finding of fact 50, or am I moving on?
That's on the sales standard, Your Honor.
Right.
But same thing. They adopted findings that contradict their own ultimate findings. Now, the board tries to argue, well, these basic findings, and if you'll turn to tab A in the handout that I provided the court, I've listed the basic findings.
Give us a minute, because we've got several handouts, and they're different cases.
Yes. It's the one that says appellant's oral argument exhibits in tab A. And it lays out there for you the basic findings that the board adopted. So what did the ALJ find? She found that Red McComb's dealership were participating in manufacturer-sponsored programs. They were adding a luxury line. They were renovating their facilities. They were becoming exclusive Hyundai dealers, while Worldcar was not. And the ALJ found this was a voluntary business decision by Worldcar not to participate. And even the board says if new Worldcar had participated, it would have allowed them to get more discretionary allocations. By not participating, they helped create the difference in allocation. How can a dealer refuse to participate, refuse to do these things, and then stand back and say, I've been discriminated against? It makes no sense. That just kills this order. The board's finding that their participation would have increased the discretionary allocations. So it might not have been 7-1. It might have been 1-1. It might not have been any difference if they had participated. And I want to emphasize this. This is not a case where both dealers were participating and investing and you still had a difference. That's not this case. They chose not to voluntarily. This isn't a case where Hyundai put up barriers to New World Car, preventing them from participating. That's not this case. This is a case where they made a voluntary business decision, and I'm not criticizing that. Some dealers want to be high-volume dealers. They're going to need a lot more inventory because they're moving those cars, and they're only making maybe $100 per unit. Some dealers choose to be small-volume dealers. They like to sell fewer cars but make a lot more money per car. These are voluntary decisions that can create these kinds of differences in allocations. So what you had here with the allocation claim was the board relying on evidence that only established a difference. It did not explain why the difference existed and how it was created. The ALJ did. They adopted those findings, and it's illogical to draw an ultimate finding of unreasonable discrimination. And if you look at the board hearing, The commissioner who made the motion that was adopted just said, I think there's discrimination here. That was not the issue. The issue was unreasonable discrimination. Until you know the reasons why a disparity or a difference was created, you don't know if it's reasonable or unreasonable. Now, moving on to the sales claim, Your Honor, we have a little bit different situation here. This is the one where it's requiring adherence to an unreasonable sales standard is what the code prohibits. The ALJ looked at all the evidence. There are over 300 exhibits in this case and 1,200 pages of testimony. And she said there was no requirement by Hyundai that they be 100% sales efficient.
That's finding a fact.
That's finding a fact 50.
Okay.
And it's expanded on, and I think even in finding a fact 51, which was adopted, which said even though Worldcar was not 100% sales efficient, they were operating under valid agreements. There was no attempt to punish them in any way. They did get a letter, a notice of failure of performance, which said, look, you're not making the sales that we think you ought to be making. And we want you to come up with a recovery plan. It did not threaten termination. There's nothing in that letter about a sales requirement. But the board makes its own basic finding of fact that there is such a requirement. Now, that's a basic finding. There's no way that's an ultimate finding. Either there is a requirement or there isn't a requirement. It's not in statutory language either. And the board cannot act as its own basic fact finder. That's the role that's given to SOA. That's what the legislature set this up for. For those kinds of facts have to be found by the ALJ. And again, they did not reject her findings on that, oh, well, your finding 50 or 51 doesn't have any evidentiary support. They didn't do that at all. They just made their own finding. They also made another basic finding to get to this result. They said we ignored or rejected their inventory request. There was evidence to the contrary that supports findings of fact. That there is no finding of fact that we ignored or rejected inventory because the evidence was we didn't. We worked with them and tried to work with them, and they refused to work with us. And there is testimony in the record, I've cited it in my brief, where we were trying to give them inventory. We offered them 100 Elantras, a model. And they said, oh, we only want 34 because we don't like some of those models. We were working with them. So in the face of that kind of evidence, and I'm not saying they might have some evidence to say, well, maybe you should have treated us better. But the ALJ who heard all this said there was no requirement, there was no, and she didn't even find a rejection or ignoring of their request because she couldn't. There was no such finding.
In the record, I know that there's some dispute as to whether Mr. Hetrick told them that he was going to try to find a way to close their dealership.
No, he did not say. What he asked them to, Your Honor, in view of their low sales, he just said, look, if you don't want to be a Hyundai dealer, I'll help you find a buyer. But he didn't say, I'm going to put you out of business. And he did not do that. And there is no finding to that effect. That would be a basic fact finding that the ALJ would have had to make. But she didn't make that finding because she was not persuaded that that happened. Now, they're going to try to tell you that that happened, but it didn't. And not only that, again, we have to judge the sufficiency of the board's order by what it says and what they find.
So going back to, basic versus ultimate facts, if the board decides the numbers, I mean, is there a number to where it doesn't matter how many reasonable, how many programs, how many things that you could say, okay, you gave one dealer, 3,000 cars, and you gave the other one 20 cars. Is there a point where you would, where the board can say, I don't care how many reasons or excuses you come?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there is, because there could be, for those business reasons, it may be that I don't want any cars. I'm just sitting back selling just very, very few, and that other dealer who gets 3,000, he's selling 5,000 cars a month. He might need more. You've got to look at the underlying reasons in every case. There just isn't a per se rule. And if they're going to do something like that, they need to go through a rulemaking, Your Honor. You don't do it in a contested case and then retroactively apply it. And that's what happened here, too. And that gets me to good faith and fair dealing. The good faith and fair dealing findings rest upon these invalid allocation and invalid sales standards findings. But more than that, they changed the rules after the game was played. The board precedent that we went to trial on was Texas Tejas. And it said to prove a good faith and fair dealing violation, you had to show that the manufacturer engaged in conscious doing of a wrong for a dishonest, discriminatory, or malicious purpose, not negligence or bad faith. The board is up front. I commend them for their candor. They say, well, we applied the CRIM standard for a 1992 Supreme Court case. What? You're applying a 1992 case when in 2009 you applied the Texas Tejas standard? This court has held over and over, principally in Flores, you cannot do that kind of thing to somebody.
But there's no court that has adopted the Tejas.
No, no court has, but it's the agency precedent, Your Honor.
And do we need to determine whether or not Tejas was properly enunciated, or is it just that the board gets to do that?
The board, if they're not bound by their precedent, but when they depart from it, Your Honor, as they did in this case, this court has held, you have to explain why you're doing it. You also have to give us notice that you may be departing from that precedent, so we'll know how to try the case. That's Flores. You have to let us know what standards are applying. You can't come up with a new standard at the board hearing after the case has been tried and apply it retroactively.
Do you think, though, that this court needs to determine whether Tejas Toyota was correctly decided?
No, I don't think you do at all. Well, it's their precedent. It's their precedent. What you do is you vacate this order and you send it back and say, okay, that's something you need to do. If you're going to change your standard, you have to do it and let these people know what the standard is, and we'd have to retry it based on the new standard.
With proper notice.
I'll reserve.
I know your time is done, and I don't need you to address it now, but in your rebuttal, will you explain to us how we have jurisdiction over all the officers and everybody else other?
Well, I'll make real quick on that, Your Honor. It's unclear in the statutes who you have to sue when you seek judicial review. And several of us in this area, we've just named everyone for fear that we're going to omit someone. I think it probably is just the board when you're challenging the board order. I agree with Ms. Watkins on that. But it would be nice if y'all would, when you write the opinion in this case, let's get that laid to rest, and then we won't have to be spending money suing Whitney Brewster and Daniel Levitia and all the other people who were involved. But it really should be the board. But that's just been an outstanding issue that's given a lot of us heartburn, and it'd be nice to get that laid to rest.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Lee Kaplan. I represent WorldCar. I want to speak briefly about the undisputed evidence that was in front of the ALJ and the board at the hearings, and which essentially made the ALJ rulings, many of them, beside the point. They do not logically support her ultimate legal conclusions. Everything I tell you is undisputed, and it comes from either exhibits or the cross-examination of Hyundai's principal, the regional manager, Mr. Hetrick. This, I think, is the most telling exhibit in the case. It's at the back of the packet I gave you. And what it shows you, it's in the record.
Is it?
Yes, it's
okay.
The very last page.
Okay.
And what it shows you is, from the time Mr. Hetrick showed up, we had discriminatory allocations. WorldCar was the same kind of dealer before and after. It shows you that when this claim was filed, in fall of 2013, the discrimination miraculously ceased, even though WorldCar was the same dealer and did not enjoy or participate in any of the programs that they make so much about. Every one of their alibis is vapor. And what the ALJ found is that it's reasonable for there to be that kind of discrimination. The only problem is the chronology doesn't work. So let's look at these alibis. One of them is, well, the McCombs dealership, one of the two dealerships there, went exclusive. That ignores the fact that the WorldCar North dealership was already exclusive. It also ignores the fact that the South dealership, WorldCar proposed to make an exclusive dealership, not keyed or not shared with a Kia dealership, by buying property on the South Loop in San Antonio, and no response was ever given. So that alibi was exploded. And to this day, WorldCar South is not exclusive, and yet somehow this discrimination ceased. Similarly, we've heard, well, McCombs did renovations. They ignore, once again, the fact that the extra allocation preceded McCombs' commitment to do renovations in one of their stores. But on the other hand, when WorldCar itself proposed renovations, it was told by letter that renovation would not necessarily be a guarantee that Hyundai would sell WorldCar any minimum number of vehicles or give them any assistance. That was Plaintiff's Trial Exhibit 72. It's the record 159215. It's also in the packet that I gave you. So,
could you repeat that record? Sorry.
Yes, it is record 159215. It's also at record 163504. That's the letter that Mr. Hetrick said, well, you can do them, but we're not guaranteeing you anything, after they had already given special treatment to the McCombs dealership.
So let me ask you a question, Mr. Kemp, because do you agree that these are basic facts, or do you think that these are ultimate facts?
Well, these are basic undisputed facts.
Okay.
Pointed out to the board in the record, and the board came to legal conclusions with these undisputed facts that the Hyundai lawyer admitted at the hearing were undisputed facts.
Okay, so I guess my question would be, can the board go outside of the finding of facts as to basic facts? I think we all agree as to ultimate facts, they can if they at least give written explanation. But as to basic facts, can the board go outside of the finding of facts that the SOA judge did and look at the record and just pull out and say, okay?
Under the statutory scheme, I think they really have to. The statute says unreasonable discrimination. We've never disputed that manufacturers can discriminate. And so the case was tried on, let's come up with some alibis, all of which are disproved. And if the ALJ simply ignores facts that are undisputed, the board has to be entitled to make legal conclusions for that. Otherwise, why do we have a board? We should just have administrative law judges and no board at all. because you can dictate the facts, the legal conclusions, if you leave out the undisputed relevant facts. I can proceed to a few more things. They talk about how WorldCard didn't do the Equus deal.
So They'll, how do
oh,
we...
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm just having trouble. How do we... What do we do with Montgomery?
I'm sorry. That's not a case I'm familiar with, and it may be that Ms. Watkins is.
34 Southwest 3rd at 564. If a board could find additional facts, it would then be serving as its own fact finder despite delegating the fact finding role to a hearing examiner.
Well, there's no real finding to be done when something is stipulated as undisputed. I mean, we know discrimination occurred. All the board really did is said these facts that the ALJ talked about are irrelevant. They all happened after the discrimination ceased.
So the fact that they are stipulated facts, then it's not a fact. The basic facts, your argument is, the basic facts are all agreed upon. It just goes to the reasonable. It actually goes to the ultimate fact.
We think so. I mean, okay. To us, they may say, well, we had pure motives. But all of these alibis are after-the-fact alibis. The Equus deal was not signed till November of 2010. And the evidence, again, is undisputed. They actually had to chase down McCombs to sign it. That's in the record at 163504. And I'm sorry, at 163507. They were already getting discriminatory allocations before November of 2010. We know that there's a complaint
Does
that...
Does the board need to set out all of these?
Yes.
Okay.
We provided a PowerPoint at each of the hearings. And the one that's in the August 17, 2017 presentation is in the record at 165049. These things were all discussed. Another thing we know is, I'd like to deal with this just very quickly, this service loaner issue. The dirty little secret about service loaner cars is that it's a deceptive program if dealers don't follow the rules and there are no rules. When
so,
you put
so
it in
So what I'm hearing, though, is that if it's because of the unreasonable discrimination, that's kind of what opens the door to these additional facts.
To the board making
consideration of these additional facts by the board.
Well, it can consider them. It doesn't have to do chapter and verse of every other fact. I mean, it had the exhibits before it that are conceded and the information. If I can just talk about the service loaner program very quickly. When you put a car into service loaner status, it counts as a sale if you're a dealer. That gooses your allocation up. You'd get more vehicles. But the warranty starts. So if you put a car in service loaner January 1st and you take it out after a month or so, you don't unreport it, and you might not sell the car till July.
But is that a business decision as to, is that something that would be part of that business decision as to whether or not you want to participate in a service loaner agreement, which would not necessarily...
I appreciate your point. Mr. Hetrick himself was told by dealers at a regional meeting this was unfair. It allowed people to game the system. Because, you know, consumers may buy the car and not know their warranty started 6 months earlier. And dealers who tell them would normally have a customer say, I want it cheaper. But WorldCar refused to participate in the program, and Hyundai admitted it has no policies to require dealers to notify customers their warranty already started. Even though Mr. Hetrick said he told somebody it'd be addressed in 2012, by 2015 at the time of the hearing, no one had addressed it.
So my understanding is these were points that were addressed in the rehearing. I guess my question is, aren't we, you know, under the cases McKillop and Levi and Sanchez and Montemayor and all those cases, isn't the board required in when they're finding to, not that they heard it and they just say, well, we disagree with the ALJ, aren't they required to put those in writing? These are the reasons why we believe that this is unreasonable.
Well, I would
give that to Ms.
Watkins,
okay.
But to me, when there's open session, and in fact, in our 2017 PowerPoint, we repeated some of the things that were said at the 2016 hearing. When in open session, a recorded, transcribed hearing, all these things are discussed and conceded, does the board really need to make more findings other than what it's actually heard and what's conceded to be true? I mean, the court may decide they need to remand for that purpose. We think it's pretty clear what happened. This evidence alone proves that every alibi they gave, every alibi, was false. And these arguments they make now were not made at any time in front of the board until much later in subsequent briefing. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Justice Triana, I'd like to address your Montgomery question first.
Thank you.
This is a different situation with different statutory permissions. The board has, under Occupations Code 2301.711, the power to make findings. In fact, it's directed to make all findings on the basis of which its decision will rest. If an ALJ omits to make a necessary finding, the board has to make it. And in fact, you'll see that in play if you look at the Tejas Toyota decision that's included in the materials behind the brief of Hyundai. There were additional facts made in that case because the director found that there were some missing that needed to be made.
But they have to make them.
They have to make them.
Okay.
They have to make them. They're statutorily mandated to.
What about these other basic facts that we were talking about earlier?
Let's talk
where
about
do they fit into this?
What's basic scheme? And what's not basic? You know, Hyundai claims that this is going to destroy the industry, that this one decision in this case with these particular facts is somehow going to undermine all manufacturers everywhere in the country. That is not the case. That what makes this situation different is that two of the statutes at issue require an assessment of reasonableness. And the reasonableness is in the context of this manufacturer and dealer's relationship. That means all of the variables are in play. There's one other competitor in San Antonio for World Car. That's a significant issue. There's a scarcity of cars. That's a significant issue. It's a different thing to give one dealer seven times the discretionary allocations if you have numerous cars available. That's not this case. This case, there was a scarcity of vehicles. And in that scarcity, Hyundai decided to award discretionary allocations seven times greater to World Car's only competitor in the city of San Antonio. The board is a policy-making body, and it should be able to say, looking at this statute and all of the variables that are uncontested, this is unreasonable discrimination between these two dealers.
And that's what allows us to get to all these other facts.
Yes, Your Honor. And I want to address your question because it's one I posed to myself as I was working on this case. Does the board have to list every piece of evidence that it considered in order to explain why it has found this is not reasonable discrimination?
We're used to seeing under, was it 05E? You know, we're used to seeing why we're departing, right?
Right, and the board did say why in these cases. That 7-to-1 disparity in the context of this case, that's what they believed made it unreasonable. And, you know, the same presentation that you had from Mr. Kaplan, the board had also. All of the business justifications that Hyundai advances for the disparate treatment. It's very important, and I want to talk about something that Hyundai said in its reply brief about my briefing in particular, that I got the year wrong when Mr. Hetrick started. I did, in fact, get the year wrong. That's because findings 17 and 18, which state that he was hired earlier, were not contested by anyone. If there was a typographical error, no one brought it to the attention of the board to get it fixed. But if you look at pages 30 and 31 of my brief, none of the statements about those alleged bases for differentiation change one iota because 2009 should be 2010. The Equus line and the sole distributor, the committed distributorship or dealership, The Red McCombs dealership that became an exclusive dealership did not do so until the end of 2010, after the 7-to-1 disparity in discretionary allocations. That dealership could not become a dealership that carried the Equus line as long as it was a dual dealership. And it wasn't a dual dealership in the same way that World Car South was. It was a dual dealership because it was doing warranty service work for GM. And its contract to continue that work did not end until the end of 2010. That's from Mr. Hetrick's testimony. He testified about talking to the Red McCombs folks, and he said the woman who was running those dealerships, Mr. McCombs' daughter, told him they would be done doing that dual service work at the end of the year, at the end of 2010, and at that point they would like to become an Equus dealer because then they'd be eligible. So the board had it within its power to look at all of these purported justifications for the disparate allocations and conclude that they were not actually supported by the evidence.
How do we, though, like, you know, with the conclusions of law where we're literally just changing a word from there is to there's not, or there's not to there is, you know, when you have, when you're supposed to explain with, you know, particularity, specific reasons for why you're changing an ALJ, how does that comply with that?
Well, for one thing, the board adopted all of the findings other than the ones it was changing, and those findings support a determination of unreasonableness. One of the things that hasn't been discussed very much is that in proximity to the South store, Toyota had put in a plant. That has two very significant effects. For one, it makes it harder for South to compete, World Car South to compete, because it's got this Toyota plant right next door. But it also, because the Toyota plant, the people at Toyota had incentives, the employees, to buy those cars, it increased the total number of vehicle registrations in that primary market area. The effect of that was to increase the number of sales required to meet 100% sales efficiency. You know, these things are not isolated things, and because the board... Yeah,
what do we do with that finding that was left unchallenged about the 100% sales?
We look at exactly what it says, Your Honor. It says...
Yeah, I can't find it. I was looking for it, and I've got it somewhere, but
it's
yeah.
Number 50,
yeah.
I believe.
Your Honor, it's on tab C.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. It says maintaining 100% sales efficiency is not a requirement to be or to remain a licensed Hyundai dealer. That doesn't mean they don't expect you to satisfy that 100% sales efficiency, and there are sanctions that can be imposed against a dealer by a manufacturer that are less than termination of the franchise agreement.
But does that finding in there, does 50...
How is that not opposite to 52, where it says that 100% sales efficiency is a requirement? I mean, I understand what you're saying, that you're arguing is, well, they're saying it's not a requirement, wink, wink. But we've got two findings of facts that seem to be completely opposite.
Well, and that's what the board corrected by amending finding of fact 52 to say, measuring
so
sales efficiency.
50 doesn't really say what I think it says. It says something different, so it's okay to stay there with 50, with the board's new 52.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the position Hyundai has taken that the board can never have a role in deciding what is reasonable. That is where this basic versus ultimate discussion came from. There has to be a policy-making role for the board in effectuating these statutes, in enforcing the statutes. The statute includes a determination of what is reasonable and not reasonable discrimination, or what is a reasonable sales standard and what is not a reasonable sales standard. And the question is, who makes that determination? Hyundai, arguing that it is a finding of basic fact says that the ALJ should make the decision. Well, the ALJ doesn't have expertise in the regulation of the relationships between manufacturers and dealers. The board does. That's what makes this reasonableness determination different than the determination of reasonableness in a negligence case for a jury. That's a fact finding. Was it reasonable for the average actor to do this? Only the board can decide what is reasonable discrimination between a manufacturer and a dealer, between two dealers, excuse me, by a manufacturer, because the board is the one with the expertise. And when you have a jury deciding reasonableness, you're talking about a reasonable person. Everybody on the jury is a person. The ALJ does not have the board's expertise. And if the court were to find that every finding of fact that is specific to this, to a case, is a basic fact, then it's going to be curtailing what all agencies can do in the way of policymaking. The board needs to be able to say in these instances what is unreasonable discrimination, what is an unreasonable sales standard, and what is not.
So do you think, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Bennett, so do you think that the board can say, looking at the numbers, you know, let's assume they weren't, we don't agree with any of the reasons for why they got more, do you agree that the board can look at it and say this on its face is almost like a prima facie case that it's discriminatory? And if so, what's that number? And if so, does that not require rulemaking?
Your Honor, I'm going to have to say I agree with Mr. Bennett on this. I do not think there is a specific number at which the board can say that's too much. All of the facts have to be considered. There may be a dealer that has so disengaged from its manufacturer's programs that its competitor dealers should get more cars. It is a factor of all of the circumstances of the case. And so that's why you can't do a rulemaking, because you can't sit down and say, okay, how do I think, what are all the unreasonably discriminatory ways that a manufacturer can allocate cars between two dealers? You simply cannot think up all of the permutations of all of those variables and put it into a rule.
And I have a quick question, too. I know you're out of time, but talk about Taos Toyota. I mean, are y'all bound by, was the board bound by that standard? If so, why not? And were you supposed to have given notice that you were no longer going to follow it?
Your Honor, as Mr. Bennett said, we are not bound by our precedent. And if the board is going to correctly apply what has been known to be the law about what is a duty of good faith and fair dealing since 1992, then it should be at liberty to do that. Mr. Bennett certainly was on notice, and Hyundai, all of Hyundai's other lawyers have been on notice since the publication of CRIM. What is a duty of good faith and fair dealing, and what does it require?
I have one question. Do you agree with Mr. Bennett that only the board should be sued, and is that something that needs clarification from this court?
I was glad to hear Mr. Bennett say that he would like for you all to write on that. It would be good for persons who want to complain about whatever action the board has taken, because it will save them a bunch of money. But it will also have the effect of having some of my clients not have to disclose that they've been sued when really they should never have been defendants in the first place. There's no way, if the court were to decide to reverse the board's order and send the matter back to the board for reconsideration, Ms. Brewster by herself could not issue a new order, nor could Mr. Avisha. So the board is the only proper defendant, and we join Mr. Bennett in saying we hope that you will write on that. I know I'm way over time, but I would just simply request that the court affirm the board's order. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Somebody left their glasses.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett.
Okay, let's deal with Mr. Kaplan first. What you just heard here is what he did at the board hearing. And what you just heard here is what you're not supposed to do, and what the Sunset Commission criticized this very board for doing. retrying the case and engaging in a fact-finding mission during the board meetings. And this I'm reading from the Sunset Commission report. While an agency's board may ultimately disagree with a SOA decision, boards do not generally relitigate the cases this way, the way the board does, effectively retrying the case at the board meeting and engaging in fact-finding missions. That's just what you heard. There, he comes up with four exhibits out of 300 that are not supported by findings of fact, that just here's an evidence here and here's something here, and the board didn't make these findings. He's just talking about evidence. That's not how this system is supposed to work. He says, well, they gamed the system with this service loaner program. Look at findings of fact. There's on page, I think it starts with findings of fact 31. It's talking about gaming the allocation system. And here's the findings of fact. The service loaner program allowed dealerships to sell cars into the service loaner program, thereby reducing the inventory available for sale and increasing formula allocations. There was insufficient evidence to show that Red McCombs gamed the system. There was no gaming of the system. This exhibit that they want to point to, all it shows is there's a difference in allocations. It doesn't tell you why there's a difference in allocation. The ALJ did. In her findings, she said they refused to participate in programs. They refused to renovate during this time period, which would have increased their allocations. You heard a lot about alibis. Alibis are pretexts. You know what those are? Fact findings, basic fact findings. There is no finding in the board's order or in the findings that they adopted about alibis or pretexts. They had the burden to secure such findings, and they didn't do it. All these findings and all these things that they want to have in the record are not there because they didn't carry their burden. And the board didn't put that in the record either. They didn't put that in their final order. Again, we judge these agency orders by what it says, not what might be out there. This court has said that in Seeley very forcefully, that the board is not free just to go out and start picking and choosing evidence when they're trying to uphold their order on judicial review. These facts were disputed. He talks about these undisputed facts. What he was talking about was undisputed, was stuff that happened before June of 2010. When McCombs took over, in the fall of 2010, McCombs was engaged in becoming an exclusive program. And we cited this at page 3 of our reply brief, pages 3 and 4, where we talk about all the things that McCombs was doing in 2010, which become findings of fact that were adopted by the board. In 2010, finding of fact 22, in 2010, Red McCombs Superior became an exclusive Hyundai dealership. Red McCombs Northwest added the luxury exhaust line that required a facility upgrade and then renovated the store. All these things were in the works in the fall of 2010. Number 28, Worldcar did not renovate a dealership until 2014 when it renovated Worldcar North. Now, Ms. Watkins said in her brief she wasn't tying all this to 2009. It was all this stuff that happened in 2010. But look at page 31. Which she cited to. She says Hyundai had exercised its discretion to favor Worldcar's only competitor with 7 times the cars based solely on its participation in the service loaner program. No, it was not. I just told you what was happening in 2010. The ALJ told you in her findings what McCombs was doing in 2010. He wasn't just participating in the service loaner program. And let's talk about 7-1. You've heard a lot about 7-1 today, haven't you? But what you haven't heard about is 3-1. They go later in their order, they talk about, well, 3-1. There was a disparity of 3-1, and that's unfair. What is it? 7-1? 3-1?
So, Mr. Bennett, how does a board make a determination about the unreasonableness or reasonableness of the program?
Yes, based on the basic findings. Why was there a disparity or difference in allocations? How did it come about? What caused it? Those are the basic findings that you have to know for the board to exercise its policy or its proper function of saying what's reasonable and unreasonable. They just can't say it's unreasonable and not have any basic findings and rationale to support that.
And so if they would have listed a bunch of factors, you would...
They could have said, you know, they couldn't on this record, but let's just say, for instance, if it was undisputed that Hundy was keeping Walcar for participating in those programs, they could add that, perhaps, if it was established as a matter of law. Or they could have sent it back, which would probably have been the more proper thing, to the remanded back to the LJ. Hey, we don't think you took a close look at the ability of New World Car to participate. That's just one example I'm giving you. But that's the proper way to handle these things. Let SOA do its job. Don't start usurping their ability to do their own job. And you start becoming just what the Sunset Review criticized them for. You're on a fact-finding mission at the board hearing. That's not the place for this. Now, counsel for the board said, well, we've got the power under 711A. Well, it's not cited in their brief, first of all. And number two, the board is subject to 058E. You read these two together. The board can make findings, but it's delegated that fact-finding. Look at point 704. The board delegates all these things to SOA. And then and that's where the fact-finding happens. Not that they get to do it on their own. And, you know, they were saying, well, there's nothing here that's going to cause the other manufacturers problems. Just read their brief. They'll show you the problems they're having. And this gets back to this. What is the standard? What is the test? What time period do you look at? We don't know. The industry doesn't know. And it's become a de facto that you have to make every allocation equal. Well, nobody, the dealers don't want that. If I'm that small volume bill, I don't want you forcing allocation on me, cars that I have to pay you for when I don't want them. So I think that to close up, Your Honor, it's a vague and confusing standard they created. And why is it a vague and confusing standard? Because they didn't follow the process. They didn't follow the APA on how this is supposed to be done. That helps ensure that we get a reasoned exercise of the board's discretion. And I would like to close with the good faith and fair dealing on CREM. CREM was a 1992 Supreme Court decision that rejected a common law duty of good faith and fair dealing in the franchisor-franchisee relationship. It rejected. The legislature came in and put it in the code. The Supreme Court in CREM didn't, because they didn't even establish what the test is. It's not just that there's a duty, it's what's the test. It establishes no test. The test was established in Texas Tejas. It told you what the test was. And they're pretty candid about, well, we didn't follow Texas Tejas. Your Honor, this order should be vacated, and this matter should be remanded to the board with instructions to follow the APA. Follow the APA process. Don't decide it like you did here. Just enter an order, first of all, just overturning it with no findings, no rationale, and then 9 months later start trying to make up facts. That's not how this is supposed to work. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The cause will be submitted.